having a say in my talk, and then I'll sit down. No, then I'll say it. I'll talk about the Oppenheim-Putnam layered world model, and it's kind of confusion, I think, about where the mental layer is supposed to live in that. I'm going to suggest that this shouldn't be surprising because the layering image is arrived at in the first place by styles of reasoning that are distinct from metapsychological reasoning about the mental. And as it happens, this distinctness of styles of reasoning is the source of the so-called heart problem. Here we get to the meaty part. The heart problem has been misinterpreted, and that's because our logical resources are insufficiently high-powered. With a beefed-up logic, and beefed up with respect to Kripke, not beefed up with respect to Kripke and Johnston in the 50s, we can implement a metapsychological expressivism with mental claims expressing kind of empathy or simulation as opposed to describing the world. So if I say Fred believes that goats eat cans, it's kind of like, here's how it is for Fred, goats eat cans. And if that's right, then the attempt to find a mental layer of reality embodies a confusion about meaning. So I'll have a sort of limited moral for the purposes of this conference. If any of you are in the business of attempting to do metaphysics for the mental, including qualia or phenomenality or fixed consciousness, whatever the jargon is today. Well, the mental doesn't have a metaphysics, so if you're trying to find it, you're guaranteed to fail, so you should stop. Otherwise, please go ahead and do all the emergentist metaphysics you like. Okay. All right, so here's the layered world image, one we all know well. There's a basis of fundamental fact, perhaps, or maybe presumably microphysical fact, and a lot of facts are dependent on that. But there are multiple layers, not just two. So this gives an indication that yet further relations of dependence hold among the dependent. And those relations are sometimes non-reciprocal. So you get this like kind of proper stacking. So for example, I don't know in science, but perhaps cellular fact depends on facts about organelles, which can turn it on facts about organic chemicals, but none of those dependencies hold conversely. And then we can talk about, you know, there are issues to be discussed about emergence, and what I know about this, I know from Professor Wilson. Metaphysical emergence. strike that in your down copy of the handout. And so perhaps some of these dependencies are mere weak emergence involving only structural or dynamical patterns and deep identities. Some of the emergence involving indication by certain such patterns of novel fundamental forces acting on the deep agenda. So, first, what is the psychological supposed to be in this? And it sort of seems like maybe not to be off on a spur or something, because the job of supplying facts about patterns and other more local facts are sort of seem to be already all filled up. So let's think about the mid-sized object layer. So it's beneath others. The layer of organisms lies beneath, in other words, has depended on it, what we call a seam or something, maybe many stratified layers, which constitute the ecological facts. So dependency passes up through ecologies from the more local to the more global. And then maybe for structural materials like boards and stones, the mid-sized object layer lies beneath a layer of the architectural facts, which in turn lie beneath a comparable seam of geographical facts, so neighborhood geography, urban geography, national geography, who knows. And then for chattels, perhaps those lie beneath the interior decorating facts layer. Where's the mental supposed to go? So it's supposed to be just above the organic. Facts about my liver and lymph nodes. But that's occupied by the organismal facts. So I'm there crowding out the mental there. Or is it supposed to be just above the organismal? But that's occupied by the local ecological. So me and the air that I'm breathing and the stuff that I'm looking at, maybe. Supposed to be just above that, but that's already occupied. But that's occupied by the meso-ecological. So me and you, let's say, all of us, the stuff that we're doing in this room together, and it's just above the meso-ecological. But you can see where this is going. It's ecological all the way up to the global ecological, the entire ecology of the planet Earth. Maybe the psychological is just above that. But that would seem to lose explanatory relevance to the here and now. And then moreover, it's not particularly plausible to think that there's a layer in any of these senses of the mental anyway. And that's this principle that I call semantic isolation. And roughly, the idea is that reasoning about the mental is very different from reasoning about the non-mental. So different how? Well, we've all seen the Eames Powers of 10 movie. I feel like that's something that's on everybody's mind, at least implicitly. So we embellish that kind of zoom way in, zoom way out with a moving camera that can point in all sorts of different directions, then maybe a kind of fictionalizer that imagines how things would look under actual circumstances. All that stuff illustrates the limited variety of viewpoint shifts that are available in reasoning about the non-mental. Zoom in, zoom out, put the camera here, point it over there, set it off on the actual possible world. But when we go engaging in reasoning about the mental, there seems to be a very different kind of viewpoint shift involved. So I shift from my point of view over to Fred's point of view, and then look at the world as from within Fred. None of that shows up anywhere in Powers of 10, even with the hypothesizer and a moving camera. Nagel points out in an unfamous footnote of a famous paper, even to form a conception of what it is like to be a bad and a fortiori or know what it's like, one must take up the best point of view. This insight was not appropriately appreciated, and in fact was suppressed in ways I narrate in that paper that footnote on the previous slide by Jackson. So Jackson wanted to think that what's really going on here is knowing facts about qualia, but unfortunately, there aren't any facts about qualia, or any facts about phenomenality, or any facts about Big C consciousness. We've learned that from Dennett, Harman, and all those guys back in the 80s. And as the Eames movie illustrates, reasoning about qualities doesn't involve any empathetic viewpoint shift. I mean, there's all sorts of qualities that are presented in that movie, but there's no shifting of from within the other. And for that matter, knowledge of what it's like is far from exhausted by knowledge of perception. Anyway, so there are plenty of mental facts that I don't know what it's like to have perceptual qualities. So I don't know what it's like to know how to sell real estate or to identify as minoritized or to attempt to do a bachelor's degree. Or to believe that Chicago is on Lake Ontario or to know Japanese. I suggested that these observations don't do a whole lot to actually get at what's fundamental about our problem. And I guess I kind of agree with that. Further work still needs to be done. Someone might complain here that that just sounds like a kind of simulationist spin of a familiar observation that there is a hard problem of mental. Obviously, everybody knows that the way that we go about thinking about the mental and about the physical is very different. But that doesn't get us anything that's worth being called semantic. Fact or how things are. Rather, it gets us what might think of meta-semantic. And how it is that we glob on to fact and how things are. So, then this what do we do about that semantically? Do we have to say that when God made the world, they did it or did add stuff to the physical basis to get the mental, and thus whether to go for a weak emergentism or a strong emergentism or something else? Hey, wait a second, says my objector, my complainant, I guess. they noticed that I analogized shifts of perspective among mental states to shifts of perspective among possible worlds. I'm going to say, well, there are all these different perspective shifts. There's a huge amount, There's move the camera around, point in different directions, there's move it off to other possible worlds, and then take out the point of view of the other. So, okay, so they're thinking that there's some kind of contextual shift suggestion involved here. So, this is a doctrine that's been proposed by Perry and others. But Dave Chalmers persuasively, to my mind, argues that that approach is going to work because we can simply fix the context by conjoining whatever our mental sentence is with "I am John Perry and it's now noon on Halloween 2012," and none of that makes our problem go away. That doesn't help us know what it's like. Okay. But that's not exactly my view. I mean, I bring this up because I'm going to distinguish what I'm about to suggest from a view that's familiar. So my suggestion is that a kind of sort of deepish, pretty deep change in the way that we think about logic is going to be required if we want to address metapsychological reasoning properly. My suggestion is not that to shift perspective to another mental state is kind of like shifting your point of view to another time or location or another coordinate system. It's rather that to shift point of view to another mental state is to take up a distinct, what I'm going to call, point of evaluation. To move your point of view off to a different instance of the kinds of things that logic cares about most fundamentally. So, traditionally, tell the possible world where the actual world is our point of evaluation. I would suggest that you have a rule over not to the possible world but to mental states. All right, so what's a point of evaluation? So I'll rehearse, so it's like the. Here's a quick rehearsal of super simplified version of old school modal model theory. I can find early 60s. So I got some language. It's got and or not, simple sentences, a box. And our objective is to define a kind of consequence relation between sets. So the gizmos that are involved there are just on the slide. So we posit a model structure. And a model structure is a pair of kind of ontology and a kind of ontology is about a state of frame of the set of possible worlds and accessibility relation. And evaluation is some function that tells you which set of possible world verify which symbol. For a little language and or not, simple sentence is a box, we can apply a notion of truth in the model structure, and the model structure is a frame and a evaluation, and a possible world for that model structure from that. Structure in one of its worlds, verify one of the simple sentences, the ith simple sentence, just if the world belongs to the set of worlds, the possible worlds proposition that evaluation assigns to that sentence. And then negation works by saying that doesn't happen, and conjunction works by saying that that happens for both the conjuncts. And then last, famously, structure or one verified box P, just if for every world that's accessible from the structure in that other world, verified P. And then last, human tails P, just if for all structures and worlds, if the structure in this world is verified P, then verified. Now, that doesn't get us what we really need, right? Because in order to be able to talk about perspective or points of view in object language, we need what's known as some kind of rigidifying device. And the kind of most famous is the actuality operator. And just to look down at the bottom, that bullet there, that's something that gives us the famous kind of 2D-ish effects that are on a given necessity, right? So it gives us the necessary posteriori, to make priori, because you got for necessary posteriori, you got either actually B is necessary or not actually B is necessary. Whether actually P is valid, but typically actually P is not valid or is not actually P. That's kind of necessary a posteriori. Think of validity as a priority. A posteriori is not, you're not valid either. And then for the consistent priori, we have the validity of P just as actually P, but we don't have the validity of the necessitation of either of its directions. That's something that's priori, but that's not. Right. Now how do we get this? So that, you know, that kind of enables us to talk about perspective. We talk about what's going on in the actual world. So the way that we get that is we have to enrich that kind of model structure approach to a kind of model proper approach. And the difference between a model structure and a model is not a very big one. A model structure plus a point of evaluation, a particular possible world, from an original model structure doesn't make up a model. And once you got models, you can talk about truth simplicitaire in the models, not just truth with respect to a model in one of its worlds. You can just talk about truth in the model. And the idea there is that models for the true of the model structure, relevant to the model, in the world of the model. And, you know, so if we define actuality, the actuality operator is put in a diagonal way. The equivalence is this. Okay, so that's a kind of bit of math from the late 50s, used with a bit of math from the late 50s. And that's what philosophers tend to work with. But it's a lot more under the sun than just that. And so in particular, general structure is what it takes to describe them, compare them, Tarski noticed in the 50s, kind of simultaneously with Kripke, but in ways that neither of them noticed, like for many decades, that you can use universal resources from universal algebra to create this thing called Boolean algebra with operators. The Boolean algebra with operators is and you can have modals that don't require kind of atomicity, that it's not like single points around, and you know, it's true like over a kind of gunky space of possible worlds. So there are all these attractive things that you can do, even for simple modal model theory with more powerful tools, as Tarski and Gunnarsson noticed in the mid-50s. Okay, now, the kind of intersection of this stuff with I've been working on this stuff for a few years, and it turns out that kind of strange sort of magical things start to happen once you start squeezing this a little bit. Okay. So I'm going to suggest that rather than having to take so, and algebraic model theory starts out by saying, okay, here's what the possible contexts are. And I don't think you need to get into the kind of propositions. You can look at these structures. Okay, so briefly, instead of constructing propositions as sets of worlds, you can characterize them in structural terms as elements of the and for that matter, you can even build out of objects that aren't propositions. That's the short version. Longer version there, or available for download. Now, the nifty thing that this allows you to do is reconceive logic as being about not preservation of truth, but rather what it is for P and TLQ is for the case that anybody who accepts P explicitly or implicitly thereby accepts Q. As opposed to whenever P is true, Q is going to be, and then, philosophy, because we care about truth or something, if you accept P, you gotta care about, gotta accept Q. Rather, no, it's just like this is direct what it is for P to entail Qs. If you accept P, you gotta accept Q. Okay, back up slightly. So, why do we want to say this? Well, one thing that pops out about the basics of model theory is if I got this, if I have a rigidifying operator, acts like the actuality operator did, but instead of having maximally determinate points of evaluation, I can get unspecific propositions. That gets you equivalence, as with actually, between P and P and its rigidification. And it also gets you the entailment by not P of the negation of the rigidification of P, but you don't get the confluence of that. So you don't get not rigidification of P entails not P. Now, that's sort of freaky because that's like a violation of composition of negation. So John Hart agree, they're like, we don't know the notion of negation, it doesn't counterpose. It's like, well, okay, sort of wait around. It gets you this non-contraposing negation. That's something that people have probably seen, they've seen before. So Steffi Alsen's awesome paper on epistemic modals from 2007 is the first place I heard of it. You get something like this also out of the work of Frank Veltman in Dynamics Man from the 1990s. What I like about this is that there's a kind of resemblance to a kind of Moorean or kind of transparent notion of belief avowal. So if we read the rigidification of P as I believe that P, then we get, well, you got it, P and I believe P and I believe P, those are the things that are kind of co-endorsed, because if you more paradoxical to endorse one but not the other. And it sort of seems more paradoxical to endorse not P, while also failing to endorse is not the case that I believe the P. But so that resemblance suggests the following interpretation for the semantical apparatus. So we think that as the point of evaluation that goes for a cookie model is a world considered power to sense. What points of evaluation of models, if you do things this way, end up representing as our belief states or contents of belief represented as mine? So it's like, okay, here's a model. It's got this point of evaluation, some proposition. It's like, yeah, it's like, well, that's not how somebody, no, that's how I see it. If I'm a guy who has that proposition. And then logical consequence ends up being preservation of endorsement. Earlier, every intelligible mental state. So it's, you know, it's liked or whatever by every, so that P entails Q, just if every P model that likes P likes Q. But what it is to like something, what that represents is to endorse it. So that's to say, and what models are intelligible mental states. And so that's to say that every intelligible mental state endorsing premise endorses the conclusion. Okay, that's what the point of evaluation represents. But then there were also all these other contents lurking around in the model. So, right, so like a Kripke model, you got to the point of the world, but then you also have all these other worlds that are sitting around in the frame. So one of them is identical to the point world, but all the others are merely possible worlds. So they're worlds considered as counterfactual from the point of view of the world considered as actual, which is represented by that model. So carrying that over to this way of thinking about things, the context is distinct from the point. Those could be interpreted as belief states or considered as other. So not my belief state, maybe friends. Like that. And last, we can get a kind of interpretation of belief ascription as a kind of basically gloss over some details in case anybody wants to know. The kind of index shifting generalization of rigidification. So, what it is to say, all right, I'll tell you. So, Fred believes that goats eat cans. It's kind of like, given my beliefs about Fred, those induce a kind of shift over from my belief state over to one thing that I take maybe to fit with Fred as my beliefs about him go. And then the idea is that, well, that shifted proposition is one that endorses the sentence, goats eat cans.
This is like sort of an analogous to stoic conditional where if PQ is true of the world, that involves is here at the world considered as actual, I kind of throw P in the mix, and then that may or may not do some kind of shift.
And if it does, then I go over to that the world to which I shift, and then I ask, is that a World War Q? And if it is, then conjecturally, anything about that. Okay. So let's go back to the time before that techie incursion and recall that we were responding to this complaint that simulationism, the idea that to reason about other minds is to shift your point of view from this one to that of the other, consider as an event. So we're trying to complain that simulationism is only metasemantic and it doesn't touch on the question of whether when God made the world. So this kind of index shifting interpretation of mental claims fills the gap between simulationism as a kind of metapsychological thesis about how it is that we go about reasoning about psychological and this kind of target issue of what's going on with reality. On this index shifting semantics for belief descriptions, we have this shift from my mental state to that of the other. So Fred, we can interpret that as representing my simulation of Fred, trying to see what it's like for him,
which is driven by the person that Fred just is.
But if that's right, and my conjecture that you can do this for any kind of psychic description is correct, Dan, it turns out that there are no propositions of psychology.
So, because of these
But there's no kind of cutting of modal space
that were done by
instead, all they do is express simulation. Yeah, so if that's right, there are no propositions of psychology. The mental clam never provides modal space, opposed to the man in the world. Meaning is instead to express a sentiment to the effect that one simulates so-and-so in a Now, if there are no propositions of psychology, then it makes no sense to ask after mental differences between possible worlds. Just what distinguishes the possible world is just anything mental I might find in them is like something that I find. Consequences God didn't stop on the physical, that could not have been because decisions about the mental. If God did not stop with the physical, that could not have been because decisions about the mental were yet to be made, because none ever had to be made and none could ever have been made. Maybe the world is purely physical, maybe it's got some non-mental stuff in it. There's a problem with the physical, doesn't have anything to do with mental. No. So, unlike type A materialism, however, semantic isolation, view that drives the mind-body problem. In the first place, namely that there is this huge difference between reasoning about the mental and reasoning about the non-mental, and we get physical information about the mental.